You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 26th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo is brought to you in association with the Glenlivet.
Hello from Midori House here in London. Welcome to Aperitivo, coming to you live from Studio One, just down the road from the Monocle Cafe. I'm Tyler Burley. On today's show.
Bye. My Abenomics.
Shinzo Abe closes the New York Stock Exchange and takes to the podium at the UN. Brett Mason and Alessio Patalano will be here to pick apart his whirlwind tour. Then our man in Santiago heads to a counterculture emporium playing to Chile's big demographic changes.
So here, before you enter, you find this reddish light. It looks like a stripper bar, you know, but it's our table. And here in our table, we have all jokes. They're mixed politics and religion.
And we'll also have a flat white or maybe something a little bit more jolly and a chat with British pop artist David Spiller down at the Monocle Cafe. All that plus some music and a look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24. That's Aperitivo with me, Tyler Burley, starting right now. Well, good evening, good afternoon, or good morning, wherever you are in the world. It's this is supposed to be a program which winds the day down here at Midori House in London, but it just feels like it's cranking up. We are almost at the end of the line, closing our November issue upstairs. Very, very busy and buzzy. And it's also been a bit of a busy news day as well. Jonathan Wheatley's here at the World News.
Iran's foreign minister has expressed hope that a meeting with the five permanent UN Security Council members in Germany, which is currently being held on Tehran's nuclear programme, will be fruitful. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said he hoped the meeting would kick-start negotiations to resolve the decade-long dispute. The United States and Iran have not had diplomatic relations since 1980, but in a television interview with the US public broadcaster PBS, the new reformist president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, said a future meeting with the Obama administration was possible.
We're speaking of two countries who have had no relations for 35 years. So it's clear that to begin talks requires some preparation work. And whenever the prep work is completed, I believe that it's possible to have a meeting.
Meanwhile, Syria has continued to dominate discussions at the UN General Assembly in New York. World leaders have continued to call for action to end the civil war, with Italy amongst those condemning the use of chemical weapons. The president of the European Council, Herman Van Rompuy, used his address at the UN to discuss Syria.
Syria, as a country, as a nation, is being destroyed beyond recognition. It will take time, courage, and perseverance to build an inclusive, a united, democratic Syria, where all Syrians can feel they belong and where all share a common future, regardless of their identity, regardless of their religion.
Foreign forensic investigators have joined their Kenyan counterparts at the Nairobi shopping centre, where an attack claimed by the Somali Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab killed at least 72 people and destroyed part of the complex. Christian Turner, Britain's High Commissioner to Kenya, says it's too early to speculate on what they might find.
Current phase is to try and ensure that the building is safe and secure, so that then the really detailed police work can begin to secure the crime scene and gather the forensic evidence. I think from what I've been told, there is a clear need to manage expectations. This could take some time. We all want answers. We all want to know who's responsible for this brutal, cowardly and unconscionable act. But we now need to let the professionals do their job.
Divers have today found what they believe to be the last two missing bodies from the wreck of the Costa Concordia cruise liner, which sank last year off the Italian island of Giglio. The huge ship was carrying more than 4,000 holidaymakers and crew when it capsized after striking rocks on the 13th of January last year, killing 32 people. Oracle Team USA has completed one of the most remarkable comebacks in sporting history to beat Emirates Team New Zealand and win the 34th America Cup. New Zealand had an 8-1 lead, but the USA fought back to level things at 8-all, taking the contest into a winner-takes-all final race, which they won comfortably. New Zealand's disappointed captain, Dean Barker, admitted it had been a tremendous achievement.
The gains that they've made is just phenomenal, and, you know, big credit to those guys. You know, they have really done an amazing job to sort their boat out, and probably a good thing for us that into it earlier. I'm incredibly proud of our team and what they've achieved. I'm gutted that we didn't get the last win that we needed to take this cup back to New Zealand, and it's very hard to hard to swallow.
And finally, in Wales, a sex shop that opened to cash in on the erotic book 50 Shades of Grey, which encourages experimentation in the bedroom, has had to close down amid a distinct lack of interest from the locals. The owner of the Nice and Naughty store has now closed her shop, and she complained that the residents of Aberystwyth are not, as she put it, kinky enough. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. I have to say, I was in Wales. It was I had my premier trip down to that part of this fair island a little bit earlier in the summer. I thought maybe a bookstore like that could have done reasonably well. I was in the town of Bilthwells. I'm not sure if you know it well.
I know it quite well. Gaynor Howells is from Aberystwyth, and I'm sure she'd find that story hilarious.
Yes, and the very lovely Gaynor Howells was in this building yesterday. But when I was in Bilthwells, there was a biker convention, which rather surprised me. There's a lot of tattooed women, a lot of women and men, of course, in black leather vests, which sort of seems to be sort of the trademark if you are there for a biker convention. I thought a shop like that would have done a roaring trade at that time.
Maybe they got to move to Bilthwells then, do you think?
I didn't know that we were subscribing to a special Welsh newswire service.
Well, you know us lot.
We'll be more news from you in about 24 minutes. It's just 1:06, coming up to 1:07 if you're listening in Singapore, 20:07 in Helsinki. It's 18:06 here in London. You're listening to Aperitivo. We're back in a moment.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong, Zurich, London, Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada City Cheche.
From London,
London, London, Caracas.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're live in Studio One here at Midori House. It's now time to take a fresh look at the top stories around the world today. And I'm joined by Brett Mason, Europe correspondent at SBS World News from Australia, and also Alessio Patilano, an Asian maritime defense expert and professor in the Department of War Studies at King's College here in London. Gentlemen, welcome.
Good afternoon.
I wanted to start with you, Brett. I was actually in front of the Melbourne branch of your broadcasting service in Federation Square last week with actually a fellow countryman, but from that other public service network, ABC. But we were broadcasting from there exactly a week ago. Well, it wasn't quite a week ago at this point, maybe a week ago plus a few hours, but absolutely fantastic. I was just going to say, it's SBS. We're huge fans here of what you do, and every time I go to Australia, I think, why, in a country like the UK, like so many other places, that, a broadcaster doesn't exist like that. And for those who aren't familiar with SBS and haven't seen our coverage of them, what would you say is the mission? What does it say on the label of the network?
Well, SBS is all about bringing the stories from around the world home to Australia in 74 different languages. We're actually one of the world's largest broadcasters in foreign language. So we have a real focus on bringing home multicultural and international news. And the people that are inside our building are incredible. We have people from all corners of the globe, and we really go to those off the beaten track locations to find amazing stories. And so far we've told 7 billion of them, and we're still counting. That's our slogan, 7 billion stories and counting. And it's a great organization to be a part of.
No, and I think also it's not just the TV side. I think a lot of people would recognize SBS, of course, for what happens in video, but also a radio service as well, which does a roaring trade. And we're going to be talking a little bit about all things Japan, hard and soft power. But it doesn't mean trade in good J-pop and K-pop as well. It seems to be some of the more popular programs, at least on the musical side, as part of your output as well.
Absolutely. Radio is actually bigger than television from our perspective at SBS. So we're bringing, as you say, all kinds of bits of the world home to Australia. And J-pop is huge. So there are a lot of people in Australia who, when they turn on their radio and they start to dialed through seem to find all these stations they never really knew existed. We've got a lot of niche audiences and they're very devoted. So we work very hard to make sure they're happy.
Alessio Patilano, class is back in session now. All of the students have scampered back.
It is. This is the first week, the official comeback, or as the French have it, is the rentrée. It's quite fun. You know, this is one of those moments in the year where there's a lot of energy going around the campus. This is one of the things that, usually academics will always tell you that we are badly paid for what we do. But there are aspects of the job that are beyond any type of rewards. Seeing all that energy around during these first weeks is one of those rewards.
People always ask us about our target reader profile, whether it's advertisers or people who have just discovered, you know, our brand for the first time. But when I think of war studies classes, can you paint an average profile? You know, is there, because I can sort of, there's certainly a reader that most, or listener or viewer that most of us have in our head. Who is the student, and where do they tend to end up?
Well, that's an interesting question, because over the past few years, because education, higher education is becoming a very expensive business and a very important investment at the personal level, we started monitoring in a very precise and systematic fashion how the audience is changing, how the student population is evolving. And insofar as war studies is concerned, it used to be until, you know, when I did the master's about more than 10 years ago, was a very Anglo-Saxon centric, with a primary population of Britons and Americans up to, 20-30%. Today is extremely international. We have people coming from all over the world. There's a lot of interest growing in terms of developing countries, emerging economies. And that brings a tremendous amount of variety of backgrounds in terms of people that come into to classes. Also, over the past 4 years, we've witnessed an incredible increase in numbers of students from Europe. And I think that's because UK higher education has a very primary spot, sort of in the world table of the world ranking of universities. In terms of where do we go after we finish at war studies? Well, again, there's an enormous amount of variety from people that work into risk assessment analysis environment to all sorts of NGOs, public institutions, the military. In fact, the funny thing is that those who actually go back and work for the military are perhaps these days only about 30% of our students. We've got lots of people actually end up in news, for example, because these days reporting going around requires an understanding of international politics. And war studies is also about that.
Mm. Is there any creeping political correctness to rebadge or relabel the class that it should be security studies and not war studies?
Some people do that. We don't. I'm very proud to say every time I go somewhere, imagine, you know, I go very often to Japan where war studies is a concept that has been banished from academia for the past 60 years. So imagine when I land there and people look at me and they ask me, say, what do you do? I do war studies. And they look at me like, right, really? What's that?
I guess in the spirit of class starting off, we should probably have a bit of a bell. Shinzo Abe,
yes.
And certainly at the top of this program, and of course, was in New York. He rang the bell at the New York Stock Exchange yesterday before he, of course, took to the podium at the United Nations.
By my Abenomics.
Now, something sort of very sweet, succinct, very sort of Japanese, sort of Genki style about that, which, I think we've sort of all come across, you know, many a Japanese leader, whether on the political level or also, corporate as well. And when I heard that, he sort of reminded me probably of three or four Japanese CEOs who I've met, who have this, that very childlike, very sort of, playful approach, which, you would never see. You wouldn't see it from another head of state, probably. And certainly, you wouldn't have the CEO of Ford or Boeing coming across the same way, even if they were delivering it in Japanese. But I'm just wondering, just from a delivery and sound point of view, I'm just wondering, Brett, what did you make of that?
It was very likable, isn't it? I mean, this is someone who's hugely popular on the world stage just for being who he is. And I think that's really, really nice, because it's a Japanese culture, isn't it? I think he's played up to that really well, and the whole way he's branded his three arrows approach to reviving the economy has gone down really well. And he's effectively trying to sell Japanese stock on an American stage. And the Americans are sick of seeing people in suits with slick pitches telling them to invest. And I think it's quite appealing. And I think there's something really likable about a world leader like this. Of course, a Japanese person I spoke to said that he's got a little bit of Boris Johnson about him, though, on the world stage. He can be a little bit vulnerable, and that's probably a weak point. But generally speaking, you know, I think he's managed to do in the last term more than what many Japanese leaders have been able to do.
I mean, Lesser, he's certainly, you know, he's managed to ride into New York at a fantastic time. Japan worked so hard. You know, they lost out last time around on the Olympic bid, of course, to Brazil. But now the Olympics will go to Tokyo in 2020. And you know, and of course, we'll come to security matters in a moment, and even what, you know, a simple and rather complicated thing like an Olympic win could mean. But certainly, probably a different level of goodwill when there's been so many issues, of course, you know, about China versus Japan, you know, where corporate America wants to see its alliances in the future as well. What was your sort of take on that yesterday? And then we can come to the UN in a moment.
I think he, you know, I completely agree with you. What he's trying to do and what he's been trying to do systematically is just to create a different image of Japan. You know, we've been accustomed for the past 10 years of a Japan that is made of these ever-changing prime ministers with ideas that we don't really understand, an economy that is some sort of standing on shaky ground, a bit stagnating. He's coming around, he's turning this around. You know, one of these last sentences yesterday at Wall Street was like, you know, you want to know why it matters to look at Japan? Buy my Abenomics. You know, that's the answer. And you turn around and you think like, well, that's a prime minister saying that. Again, it's a bit of a very light approach, if you want. But coming from Japan, it really makes people think, huh, something, you know, there's a new kid around the block.
Mm.
And it's very cleverly pitched to the US audience, isn't it?
Absolutely.
A real buzzword that you can see on our tweet streams the last 24 hours have been lighting up with that concept, and I think it's very smart. It's sort of East meets West on Wall Street.
You know, there was this passage in the discussion or in his speech when he started talking about the Shinkansen, the bullet trains, which is something very simple, and you know, everybody can empathize with that idea. And was saying, well, if you apply it here in the United States, all of a sudden you would be able to save money on energy or consumption. Mm. You know, that is the type of bell that resonates to the men on the street.
Well, I mean, he does pull into the station in New York at another time as well, when, you know, Japan has pressed play on, you know, the magnetic levitation train is going to happen between Tokyo and Nagoya, and of course will eventually stretch and snake, you know, further south as well. You know, which is quite remarkable. You know, find that the Chinese did it with German help in Shanghai. But I mean, it reminds you of Japan in the late 60s. And I sort of think back to all of these great pictorial journals. I think they were like Japan Illustrated. It was wonderful, glossy propaganda that they used to drop off at our school. And I can remember this sort of, in the 1970s, looking at these, you know, these marvelous trains and Mount Fuji in the background. And it's interesting that, you know, this maglev technology is going to happen. Yeah, of course, they're saying it won't be ready in time for 2020, no matter what they do. But yet you sort of wonder, you know, the Japanese often surprise you. You know, you know, the time it takes the Japanese to put up, you know, a building, they give you a schedule and then they always beat it by 18 months. So, you know, who knows? Maybe they will, you know, pull a bit of a bunny out of the hat, you know, just in time for that. So do you feel that there's, you know, find that, of course, you know, we won't even get into the issues of and then the PR disaster, which continues to be Fukushima, but that maybe there is a bit of a new wave, I think, with this Olympic momentum, you know, big infrastructure projects, and still a sense, Brett, to maybe also dazzle, you know, not just America, but the rest of the world, that that, you know, Japan has a few surprises.
And you know what? I think it's also to dazzle a lot of Japanese investors, too, and remind them that they come from the world's third largest economy, that they're a country that, as you say, has an enormous reputation for over-delivering in terms of projects and infrastructure and foreign investment. So I think that there is certainly a level of, you know, reminding the Japanese that they come from a wealthy country and a prosperous country. And a lot of his stimulus has actually seen the Japanese reinvesting in luxury products and villas. And I think that's very important. And now, given that they've won this Olympic bid, I mean, we've seen in Sydney, where I live, what happens when an Olympic Olympics comes to town. We've seen it here in London. This is a huge opportunity. It's probably a political once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for the Japanese government. And I think he's seen that and he's seized and has run with that. And also, definitely, I think within Asia, and I think that that's what we've seen in the last 6 months, there's been a huge Japanese investment outside of Japan within Asia. And then that's very telling, very, very telling.
Alessi, what does this do within the neighborhood, though? You have an Olympic win, which, of course, this is, you know, it means, you know, of course, it's an economic boom for Japan, infrastructure projects, all of these things. But then you look at sort of as it ramps up, you know, there's all kinds of different sectors which have to sort of, you know, lobby for other contracts. They're going to be landing at Narita. They're going to be landing at Haneda. But then they do have to bounce over to Seoul, and they do have to go to Shanghai and Beijing. So, you know, if we sort of, you know, pivot a little bit to what this means, you know, for security in the region as well, when suddenly, you know, all eyes are going to be on the region because, you know, Japan's win is the neighborhood's win as well. You know, what does that do? And will it have any effect, of perhaps not in the short term, but, you know, 24 months out, 36 months out, you know, what it means?
I think we're standing at a crossroads. In the neighborhood, different elites in power, whether it is South Korea, whether it is China, they have to start thinking about the implication of such an important event coming their way. It's still a few years down the road, but the current situation, particularly as it evolved over the past year and a half in terms of security, does raise important question as to how far you can push a national agenda, particularly when it comes to concepts that are competitive by definition, like the territorial dispute. You know, you have to start thinking seriously how you want to place them on your national security agenda, how important they are. Because as you said, it is not just about that. That could provide at the national level a domestic win to whoever is in power, but regionally, it could be a disaster for economic and business opportunities. And we all know that South Korea, China, Japan, in this respect, are very interconnected. We're talking about pop culture. And they don't have the luxury to look like they're squabbling around a petty national quarrel.
Isn't it a diplomatic opportunity, though, a huge one for, say, Japan to reach out? And that's what he said he wants to do, reach out to China, reach out to Korea, reach out to these other countries that are sitting there. The Olympic spirit is like FIFA, isn't it? It can bring even the most venomous of enemies together because it's in the goodness of the sport. So here is a great opportunity to bring these nations together and talk about a shared interest, combined projects, whether or not that can happen. That's going to be the test. But I think so, because there is so much for the region to benefit from Japan's win. So I think that there is going to be a definite chance for those nations to reach out and work together.
Gentlemen, we're going to take a very short break, and I want to go beyond the neighborhood to the region. And when we come back, we'll also play a little clip, of course, of Obama's address as well. He sort of left Asia, you know, quite fully out of the equation. You're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. We're back in a moment.
The Glenlivet is the original Speyside single malt whiskey, and since 1824, its flavour has defined the region. Join master distiller Alan Winchester to determine the future of this historic distillery. Three new whiskies will set sail around the world, and members of the Guardians of the Glenlivet are invited to decide which will become the Guardians chapter. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians of the Glenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
And you are back with Aperitivo here on Monocle 24, just 18:23 here in London. And my guests today are, of course, Brett Mason, Europe correspondent for Australia's SBS, and also Alessio Patilano, who is, of course, at the War Studies Department at King's College here in London. Gentlemen, just before we went away to the break, we touched on Obama and his rather long, three quarters of an hour address to the United Nations. Let's just have a listen to the clip first.
I must be honest, though. We're far more likely to invest our energy in those countries that want to work with us, that invest in their people instead of a corrupt few, that embrace a vision of society where everyone can contribute, men and women, Shia or Sunni, Muslim, Christian or Jew. Because from Europe to Asia, from Africa to the Americas, nations that have persevered on a democratic path have emerged more prosperous, more peaceful, and more invested in upholding our common security and our common humanity.
Shia or Sunni, Muslim, Christian, or Jew, not a Buddhist in sight. And there wasn't a lot of Asia in there, just because of simply where the focus had to lie over the, well, last month, even, you know, year indeed, with events in the Middle East. It did seem, you know, rather curious, though, when, of course, you know, all eyes continue to be on Asia.
And I think that a lot of Asian people and companies and investors noticed that. It was quite a bizarre omission, wasn't it? It was very telling. And I was listening to that speech and I was waiting for that Asian moment to come, and it didn't. Barack Obama has connections personally to the region, so it was obviously quite a deliberate step to avoid talking about it. And the big thing is there is enormous confidence when you speak with people who work in economics in that region. All this attention on the Middle East is diverting eyes away from what's going on there. It's seen increasingly as a stable region, as it should be, a prosperous region. And all this mess and this hoo-ha going on over in the Middle East is really playing nicely into their hands in Asia. But quite extraordinary, as you say, for him not to even touch ever so slightly in 45 minutes.
I mean, yeah, and given the fact that we're, of course, you know, the seat of and the engine of the world's biggest economy. at least to sort of make a nod as well to Asian markets. You know, never mind that, you know, things are sort of, you know, reasonably good when you compare it to other corners of the world. And Alessia, what did you think?
No, I thought that that was definitely the case. It was kind of strange, but at the same time, one should, you know, should kind of ask the question: have we heard anything important coming from the Obama administration so far as Asia is concerned in terms of new ideas for the near future? That's something that's been missing for a while. You know, when you look at the region, I was quite struck that if you settle down and you look at the sort of dialogue with key partners in the region, whether it is Japan or Australia, the dialogue has been about sort of very detailed elements of the relationship, not about where do we want to take this region. You know, what is our collective effort going? There wasn't much of that going on. You know, so far as Japan is concerned, for example, it's striking that most of the discussions are about, most of the time, sort of real estate agency type of discussion about, you know, where do we want this base? Here, there. You know, that is not conducive to the bigger problems and the bigger opportunities, as we were saying earlier on about the region.
And what's interesting, too, is a lot of Asian countries aren't necessarily talking about America. There's been a real shift in the last few years with Asia being wealthy enough and now confident enough to go it alone without the US of A hanging there as part of the journey.
Now, I don't want you to be the spokesperson for the fine nation that you hail from, Brett, but I can't sort of let you off having just been to Australia and new government in place, and some, you know, some serious question marks about not just issues.
I thought you were going to ask me about the weather.
No, not that. I mean, weather was fantastic. You know, listen, I got on my Qantas flight out of Brisbane. It was absolutely lovely. No, that was all fine. But when we look at you know, issues concerning Indonesia, but this new government and its role and interaction, you know, with Asia, not just talking about the immediate neighbors, but, you know, obviously, you know, when Mr. Abbott, you know, goes up to Tokyo for the first time in his first visit to Beijing, what type of work needs to be done from Canberra side?
A lot, and that work has been happening, I think, preemptively. I mean, people in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade would not talk publicly about it, I'm sure, but I think that there has certainly been a diplomatic readiness for a change of government. And it's very telling that Prime Minister Abbott, I'm still getting used to saying that, has chosen not to make his first visit to the United Nations in New York. He's held out, effectively, to go to Asia, and he has a problem on his hands because one of his key election promises was to stop the boats, turn around the boats. Globally, the number of people arriving by vote in Australia is very, very low. But within the Australian electorate, it's a huge political issue. It's a very divisive election issue, but it certainly played into a big part of his winning of this election. And now he has to somehow go to Jakarta and say, I've promised to stop these boats. I've promised to turn them around. How he deals with that without being offensive, without talking down to one of our nearest and most important neighbours is going to be incredibly difficult. This is a step back to his predecessor, John Howard, one of our longest serving prime ministers, who also had to walk a very wobbly tightrope with Indonesia, and there are going to have to be some very, very smooth talking conversations.
Very quickly, just before we go, though, and I want to ask both of you, if you are sitting at the Ministry of Defence in Canberra, is this government good news? Are they going to come good on the promise for more submarines? You know, will they continue to stick by this notion that they will be sort of the mini super cop for the region, or is it going to be sort of a series of cuts when we see a scale back?
I think the likelihood is that there will be a rethinking about the promise made earlier, because I think some of them were beyond a certain reach. We've seen with key programs in the defence industry complex, particularly with the submarines, as you were saying. Now the Australians are moving slightly back from we have to get the submarine by ourselves, and they're looking at options, particularly with Japan. Mm-hmm. And that is a very interesting development, which in a way would kill more birds with one stone, because it would strengthen the partnership, keep the Australian defence industry alive, and also develop a niche for themselves, which is quite important if you're a country like Australia who wants to come up with a defence sector that can't cover everything but wants to have certain sort of edge in the field.
Mm. Brett, do you think if you're a general in charge of Northern Command in Australia, you've got a pretty safe post right now?
I think so, but I would be very sceptical. I mean, these are big promises. These are very big promises, and they're so broad that to deliver them in the electorate's eyes is going to be very, very difficult. But there are also enormous practicalities, and it's very similar in a way to what we've seen with the US in the Middle East, playing this sort of region police, promising to protect the borders, strengthen. This is an enormous area, very expensive, and the government has made a lot of other promises it has to deliver on. And I think this first term is going to be critical. And what we'll see is a prime minister who will be diplomatically working Southeast Asia like probably never before since we saw with Keating. I think he's going to have enormous problems. We have offshore asylum processing in various countries now. There's concern about how long that will last. And, I think he's got a very difficult job. And I think that he's going to be held to account for a lot of these things. But as you say, there are some interesting promises and projects underway that provide an enormous opportunity. I wouldn't like to be the man answering that phone when the boats start arriving in Australia. It's going to be a very difficult job.
Brett Mason from SBS News Australia, based here in London, and Alessio Padalano from the Department of War Studies at King's College. Gentlemen, great to have you on the program. You're listening to Aperitivo.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
Od London, du var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Just gone 18:33 here in Studio One. It means we're a little bit late for the news, but plenty still to come, of course, over the next half hour of the program. We'll be heading down to our cafe to talk to the British pop artist David Spiller, and we'll preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and the Monocle Daily. But Mr. Jonathan Wheatley is back with the World News headlines.
Thank you very much. Iran's foreign minister has expressed hope at a meeting with the five permanent UN Security Council members and Germany, which is currently being held on Tehran's nuclear program, that meeting will be fruitful. The foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said he hoped the meeting would kickstart negotiations to resolve the decade-long dispute. Meanwhile, Syria has continued to dominate discussions at the UN General Assembly in New York, where leaders have continued to call for action to end the civil war there. Divers have today found what they believe to be the last two remaining bodies from the wreck of the Costa Concordia cruise liner, which sank last year off the Italian island of Giglio. The huge ship was carrying more than 4,000 holidaymakers and crew when it capsized after striking rocks on the 13th of January, killing 32 people. And foreign forensic investigators have joined their Kenyan counterparts at the Nairobi shopping centre, where an attack claimed by the Somali Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab killed at least 72 people and destroyed part of the complex. Britain's High Commissioner there says it's far too early to speculate on what they might find. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. You're taking us all the way up to midnight tonight.
Absolutely, yes.
You haven't found any other sort of fill-ins upstairs for us? No.
No, afraid not. No.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to leave you then to probably shuffle off and get dinner. And the cafe is still open for another 26 minutes, which is of course, good news here on Aperitivo, because it's time to leave the studio right now. That's, of course, the studio here at Midori House. Today, we meet British artist David Spiller, whose solo exhibition at London's Portland Gallery opens today and stays there until the 18th. Of October. Spiller's work ranges from expressionism to pop, which is lucky as the British variety of that form is all the rage right now in the art world. Just look to Christie's and Sotheby's, which are both running pop exhibitions at the moment. David is at the Monocle Cafe now with our very own Sophie Grove, who's not in Istanbul right now. She's here to finish and close the issue, which she's doing brilliantly. Good evening, Sophie.
Good evening. Hi.
Hello.
Well, I'm here with David. Welcome to the cafe, the Monocle Cafe. David, your show at the Portland Gallery opened last night. Tell us about that. How did it go?
It was very busy. It was very, very busy. And a lot of people you know from teaching and from clients that you know from America, whatever, people from the hotels that are around there know the work. So it was quite a big party, as it were, which is what it should be.
I hear you're a little bit mobbed, but tell us about the show itself. It's something of a retrospective, some works that you've squirreled away, some of your favourite pieces, but also some pieces from the more recent past. Give us an insight into what's on show.
Yeah, well, I didn't think I was squirreling them away, but I guess I was. You're right, because I put a ticket up that says not for sale. And that's quite good. It shows you I'll stand by it myself and put it on my own wall, which is a good thing. What we've started to do is to try and show people where the work I'm doing now comes from. And so there's a sort of paintings from different ages of the thing. So, which has worked quite nice for me, and it's not a great number of paintings, but it gives you a good view of the painting of it.
And tell us about your style, your work in general. You've been described as a pop expressionist, which is rather a technical way of looking at your work. But there's lots of characters from the popular iconography. We've got sort of, you know, Snoopy and Popeye popping up quite frequently. Tell us why you include those types of characters in your work.
Do you know, I think portraiture is a fantastic thing in painting. You know, Vincent said it was the greatest thing you could do is paint people's portraits. I'm painting portraits. Popeye. And they're characters that I know and don't mind me using them. And I think that I can't, I mean, it could be the only, like some artists have one subject, but I try to keep spreading it, but it always comes back in there. So they're the things I saw as a boy, and I learned to draw Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, and all those things. And so those, a lot of people have a great sympathy with them. You see them everywhere. You can see them in Africa and starving children. You can see it everywhere. So everybody's, there's a kind of common thing we've all got in seeing this image. So I'm aware of that, aware of it.
And tell us where it all began in a way. You were just mentioning the sort of genesis of your work when you got headhunted to teach at in Oxford, and you were working at the Slade, and then you started practicing really mainly in Germany during the 60s. Do you think that was the most formative time when you sort of defined your work?
No, it's it's every day. Every day I can stand and look at it and think, what the hell am I going to do? And I like that. I like that I've got to make some purpose of life, whether it's with my friends, Mickey and Donald and all that. I've got to present them, and I keep pushing out another piece of music at them or whatever a way of doing it. I love the making of the things. And I hope one thing other artists will recognise is that it's well made.
And you're using lots of very familiar quotes from songs. Bob Dylan's in there, the Beatles are in there. You know, you work with music and the cricket playing.
Well, they make me cry. They make me cry. Well, so does the cricket sometimes. They do. Well, I've forgotten what we were saying now.
We were talking about the songs and the notion of love. There's a lot of love in your painting.
Bob Dylan, it's a fantastic bit of writing. I love the abstract writing as well, which is, you know, you used to get in the 50s, which was wab-bab-a-loo, wab-bab-a-loo, and you'd think, well, this is a fantastic, I know what it means, like a piece of opera will come on, can make you cry, and a bit of this other stuff, you'll get up and jiggle about. And so I would like to get them up jiggling about, I guess.
Well, jiggling about, I'm sure they are. I mean, it's very interesting to see also, you know, how you're evolving that notion of typography and those quotes, you know, as generations change and associations change. Do you think that's a challenge for pop artists like you?
I don't think I do pop art. I think I decided to sort of jump images. I thought if you were a film director, you're making a movie, a love story, you could be then making a cowboy movie, you could take your interest in making that come to the board. And the same is with the painting. Some of it you could call pop art, but whatever that is. But some of it is just pure abstract stuff, you'd say. So I don't kind of... I think maybe we'll have to invent a new form, what we're going to call it, you know. I don't like any of those things, like, you know, they do label with people with.
Well, David Spiller, thank you very much for joining us here in the Monocle Cafe. Back to you, Tyler, in the studio.
Thanks, Sophie. And I believe you've got some pages waiting upstairs that need to be cleared, but certainly no jiggling about as you run back up Chiltern Street. Next up, our man in Santiago visits a counterculture emporium. But before that, though, it's just a 2:41 in Tokyo. It's 18:41 here in London. It's 10:41 in the morning in Vancouver. This is Aperitivo on Monocle 24.
The rugged and romantic Scottish Highlands are not the Glenlivet's only inspiration. Since 1824, this single malt has combined unique flavours to create one of the world's most awarded whiskies. The Guardian's Chapter is their next limited edition whiskey, with a taste that will be decided by the Glenlivet's own community of enthusiasts from around the world. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet. The single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
And welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Tyler Brule, here on Monocle 24. Our man in Santiago, Chile, says the city is changing. People are having children at a later age and they're earning more money. That means that for the first time, there are people in their 20s and 30s who are looking for interesting bars and restaurants off the beaten path. One company is riding this demographic change with tremendous success. Pasto Seco is best known for a pub called The Clinic, but it's fast expanding into a counterculture emporium. Steve Bodzin met the company's art director, Danny Meechan, to find out more.
I'm walking around a classic Santiago palace with a bearded guy in a leather jacket. He's taking me from one room to the next, explaining what happens in each.
So where are we now?
This will be a VIP room. This will be a new bar called Tabernilla. You can buy here wine and cheese and hams.
So this space, another bar?
Yeah, this is called La Joda. This place is supposed to bring a lot of people without tables. Just, you know, everybody is standing up.
Just to be clear, you're saying that these places are going to turn into new bars, but I know that they're already in use at least sometimes, right?
Yeah, usually on Fridays or Saturdays we have live bands.
Yeah. We go back downstairs.
So where are we now?
This is the store I was telling you about. We have designs from independent designers, you know, clothing. We have music, books. This is the cafe, right?
The cafe connects to a gallery of graphic art and design, and then a new 55-seat movie theater that specializes in art films and documentaries.
If we go through these other stairs for the second floor, you can find Happy Jane, which is a sex shop. It's not ours, but we thought it was a good idea to have a sex shop here.
Here we've got, what's
this? We have a bike parking space, you know, for, you know, lots of people now are using more bikes in Santiago. And now we are in the bar, Bar the Clinic.
Bar the Clinic. So the building as a whole is called Radicales.
The whole building is called Radicales, and Bar the Clinic is inside the building Radicales.
So this bar, how long has it been here?
This bar has around 3 years and a half, but it feels like it's been forever, you know?
One wall is decorated with gravestones for conservative politicians who've fallen out of favor in recent years. There are cartoons making fun of President Sebastián Piñera. A wall-sized poster mocks ex-dictator Augusto Pinochet. Much of the design is based on the weekly newspaper, The Clinic, which is a mix of left-wing politics, opinion, and general mockery.
Okay, we're going to the second floor of Bar the Clinic.
He shows me different theme rooms, including the chapel.
So here, before you enter, you find this reddish light things. It looks like a stripper bar, you know, but it's our chapel. And here in our chapel, we have all jokes. They're mixed politics and religion, you know.
After the tour, we sit down in the movie theater, and I ask him how he and his partners ended up running a bar.
The Clinic, it's a newspaper, right? And we offered them to make a bar. So we made a business partnership. This place is not owned by the Clinic. We own this place and we pay the Clinic for the use of the brand. And we started with a few jokes from the newspaper. And during these 3.5 years, we've been thinking, you know, about how to make this a better place. And now we're connected, but not the same.
What I am most curious about is why the Clinic is booming now. Why are there no other bars or emporiums, counterculture emporiums like this in Santiago?
Well, for one thing, we are in the centro. Lots of people come down to centro, you know? We have lots of different customers. It's not that only wealthy people come here. We have wealthy people and we have students here. I think it happens now because Chile is changing, I think, in all the ways. We used to talk about freedom before. And now we actually living freedom in a way. We have more yuppies in Chile today.
I want to know about this one bar you're building, La Joda, because you mentioned that people will be standing. And that's something that in South America, other than a couple places in Sao Paulo, I have never seen a bar in South America where people stand.
You know, lots of people of different countries come here. Lots of them. So we thought, just what you're saying, there are not many places here in Santiago to meet people. Most of the offer of restaurants and bars are to go with friends. I don't know a place here in Santiago where you can go alone. Mostly people think that's just sad, you know, but we think there's a lot of people like that. And in Bar the Clinic, it's hard to meet people. Most people come here with friends. I have never seen, from time to time you see a table with one person, but it's not something that will make you meet people, you know, unless you're a really gorgeous girl, you know. But in these two places, in La Joda and in Nación Pisco, we're thinking about the chance for you to meet people.
Are there plans for new locations or anything?
I think Radicales, we can expand. We're hoping 5 to 10 years to be maybe in Valparaíso, in Concepción, with the Radicales concept. And if we have a Bar de Clinic there, good. If we have another bar, good too, you know. But that's a 10-year plan.
Why the name? Why Radicales?
What started happening in Bar that we had really creative and fun ideas that were not fit in the bar, you know, more edgy ideas, you know. We thought about many names in regard of fun things, art, buying stuff, you know. We feel more radical. We want to invite radical people. And if you're not radical, maybe you can come here and feel a little radical, you know? I think that's what happens basically in Bardeglinic, you know? Maybe you're not that edgy, but you come here and you feel more edgy.
For Monocle in Santiago, this is Stephen Bodson.
We're just at 18:49 here on Aperitivo on Monocle 24. I'm not sure about you. I feel like a song right now. I feel like going to Toronto, my sometime hometown. It's a bit of a premiere. If you're in Toronto on October 19th, that's when a good portion of the Monocle crew are going to pull into town for a special signing that we're going to be doing at our bureau and shop on College Street, which of course is for the Canadian release of the Monocle Guide to Better Living. If you venture to the back of our bureau, you'll find a gentleman by the name of Gilbert Masuda. And he is one part of the Toronto-based group called The Precious Lows. We've played them a couple of times. Anyway, there's a wonderful new song that is out. It's called More Than Friends. They've collaborated with the very, very talented Maylee Todd. And Maylee Todd was on very, very heavy rotation in my car this summer. And you absolutely have to get your hands on her new CD if you get a moment. But here is More Than Friends. Precious Lows there with More Than Friends. And that's, of course, Precious Lows featuring Maylee Todd. It's just 18:54 if you're listening in Toronto. I'm now joined in studio, though, by Dominic Reynolds. Of course, everyone will... He says Dom on the script. I'd like to call you Dominic.
I know. I like a bit of formality.
I do.
It's the only office in the world where people lengthen their names, and I'm up for that. I like it.
And I'm also joined by one of our producers, Barbara Feeney. Dueling programs, different parts of the schedule. Dom, well, you have to represent both, though, because you'll be, of course, taking over the helm here shortly for the Globalist Asia, but then you'll also be back in with Andrew Mulder again for the Monocle Daily. God, we work you hard here.
I know, but I am fighting the corner of Globo Asia. You know, if Monocle 24 is a wine cellar, I like to think that Globalist Asia is a Bordeaux, and it's a particularly good vintage tonight. We're starting in Sudan. I've just watched some pretty shocking footage of people attacking and burning petrol stations, and people are protesting over the price of fuel. A subsidy's been lifted. Of course, big questions about where this is going to go. Omar al-Bashir's been in power for more than 20 years. He'll be looking to Egypt and wondering if he's going to be getting a similar fate. And interesting questions about the seceding of South Sudan. Mm. It took all the oil, and now they're in a bit of financial trouble. So that's going to be top of the show. We're also going to be in Malaysia, where minority groups are complaining about a brain drain. The 10% Chinese and 10% Indians are saying the policies that are being put in place to prioritise other people affirmative action mean we're going to get out of here and you're going to be stuck.
And so people who tune into the Globalist Asia, will we find out where the Indians and the Chinese are going?
We probably will, okay, although well, we hope I won't tell you now.
Well, no, please don't. I mean, obviously people won't be joining you in an hour and 5 minutes time. And beyond Malaysia and, of course, being in Eastern Africa, where else?
Okay, well, I like to learn something in a show, and I don't know anything at all about sailing.
I think
sailing.
Lots of our listeners do as well.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Well, I would hope so. And those who don't know anything about sailing can join me in ignorance being turned to knowledge tonight, because we're talking about the America's Cup. Apparently, New Zealand were ahead, but the US won, surprisingly.
Yes, and the Kiwis are rather upset, from what we gather.
So I believe.
Little clip in the news earlier. Barbara, you've got, of course, Monocle Daily coming up in 2 hours and 4 minutes' time.
Indeed.
So we're 2 hours and 4 minutes? No, it's not. It's three hours. I know. I didn't want to put you in a panic. I was just testing you.
2,200 hours.
Yeah. Tell me.
So we are going to start off looking ahead to the implementation of the Health Care Reform Act in the US. So Obama was speaking a little earlier today, kind of defending what's going to be implemented. Mm-hmm. And as we know, the Republicans have been kind of constantly bashing it. So we're going to look ahead and see. Obviously, there's going to be some hiccups as it's implemented next week. And we're going to kind of look at that. And then we're going a little further north to Montreal to look at their bike share scheme, which is in a bit of financial trouble.
So, well, yeah, not just the bike share scheme, the whole damn city I would imagine, does the word corruption come into any of this, or we're going to find out?
We're going to find out with our man there, Patrick Pittman, and we're also going to look a little bit more broadly at bike share schemes in North America and some other cities around the world and see how they're faring.
And which is curious as well, because also, you know, Montreal is home to at least one headquarters for one of the major global bike share scheme companies, which of course are, you know, not just licensing technology, but entire concepts as well. And nice to hear that our Patrick Pittman, he's traded in the Southern Hemisphere, and he's wound up in Montreal as well.
Yes, this will be one of his first reports from his new city.
Well, I'm going to let both of you go back up and prepare shows. Dominic Reynolds is going to be looking after, of course, both the globalist Asia, which is coming up in a little over an hour's time here. And of course, as we were saying, we've got, of course, the Monocle Daily coming up in 3 hours and 3 minutes. Barbara Feeney, thanks very much for that. That's almost all the time we have for today's program. I want to say a big thanks to our earlier guests. And we were talking about all things in terms of Japan and, of course, Shinzo Abe, of course, being in New York and ringing that bell at the New York Stock Exchange. So thank you to Alessio Patalano, who was here earlier from King's College in London. Also, Brett Mason from the Australian network SBS. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. And just a bit of trivia, Daniel has a master's degree in war studies from King's College. I wonder how he managed to book that guest. The show is researched by Alexa Firminich. And our studio manager behind the glass is Mr. Alex Funnell, looking very fine. Also talking about war studies as well. He's, as ever, sort of sporting a little bit of a samurai bun today. Next up is The Urbanist, and this week's topic is experimentation. The team are looking at the cities that are coming up with unconventional but innovative ideas to improve their cities. Let's have a listen. Maybe no time. Let's have a listen.
Every place that we work in, we try to develop unique strategies because we think that cities and places should have their own development. We're not making copy and paste urbanism.
And from all of us here at Aperitivo, it's goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.